morning. So yeah, we're in a series in the book of Ruth. So we're in chapter 3 this week. We're right in the middle. I've always loved the book of Ruth. And I think partly I identify with Ruth because I grew up in a different country from the one I live in now. So, you know, there's something there. It's a really beautiful story. It starts with a tragedy, moves through uncertainty, and has a happy ending. So what more could you want? But beyond that, it's a true story. And that's important to remember. And it shows in a really powerful way that is, as we live very ordinary lives, but seeking to honor God, he works on our behalf behind the scenes in ways that we could never imagine, and we certainly couldn't orchestrate without his divine intervention. And that's what we mean when we talk about God's providence, right? God's working even when we can't see it or we don't understand it. So in the book of Ruth, we've been seeing the radical effects of this Hebrew word, chesed. Chesed is this powerful word. It's difficult to capture in English what it means. It's also difficult to pronounce if you pronounce it properly because it has a little Hebrew thing at the beginning, you know, chesed, right? So I will say chesed this morning because that's a whole lot easier and easier on my throat. But this word, it's really too big for our vocabulary. So it's kind of fun as we go through the book of Ruth to see in each chapter new and each section, new things about what chesed really means. So ultimately, chesed is a characteristic of God, but he shows it in the story through the key characters, just as he often shows his chesed to us through other people. So in chapter 1, we saw that chesed is a profound, loyal love, right? When Ruth pledged herself to her mother-in-law, this really strong language in chapter 1, verses 16 to 17, Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you." That's a strong, profound, loyal love. And then in chapter 2, we saw that chesed is lived out in generous acts of kindness. We saw that as Ruth works hard gleaning to provide for her mother-in-law, and Boaz provides protection for Ruth while she's working and tells her to stay close to his own workers, making sure that his own harvesters don't strip the field so that there is something left over for her to gather. And so then later in chapter 2, we saw that chesed is an abundant, satisfying love. Ryan talked about that last week. As Ruth and Naomi find themselves with more than enough food, it's hard work for Ruth, but the work's fruitful, and because of Boaz's protection and generosity, she and Naomi are well provided for, far more than they would have expected when she first went out to glean. And I think most of us who were here last Sunday left kind of excited by God's abundant and satisfying love, because Ryan's very excited when he preaches, so you can't help capture that, which is awesome. So Ruth and Naomi were blown away by Boaz's kindness, and no doubt they were relieved that they had plenty of food stored up for the winter. But the story doesn't end there. I was a little tempted to title this week's message, "But wait, there's more." And then actually, Isaac, when you carry on next week in chapter 4, you could title it, "But wait, there's still more," because the story really builds as it goes through. As we go through this story, we're going to see that our understanding of God and of his chesed is going to continue to grow chapter by chapter. There's a lot in today's chapter, and we're doing the whole chapter in one go this week. There's no commercial breaks, so I hope you got your snacks, your coffee. The main thing I want you to hold on to today is the way that chesed cultivates hope. Chesed, this profound, loyal, generous, kind, abundant, satisfying love, creates an atmosphere in which help just can't help but grow. And we're going to see the effects of hope as the story unfolds. So Ryan talked about the beginnings of this hope last week in chapter 2, when he talked about how chesed awakens hope in bitter hearts. At the end of chapter 1, Naomi was so bitter about the loss of her husband and both of her sons, which is understandable. That's a boatload of loss. She was identifying with her bitterness so much that she actually wanted people to call her Mara, which means bitter, rather than Naomi, which means pleasant. Because from her perspective, there was no longer anything pleasant going on in her life. Never mind that Ruth was standing right there and she just made this beautiful pledge committing herself to her. She just couldn't see anything good. And perhaps you've been there. When we're disappointed or we're grieving or hurting, sometimes we can't imagine anything good in our future. Perhaps you're there now. And if you are, I'm really glad you're here. But in chapter 2, we saw Naomi's heart start to awaken as she experienced more and more of God's chesed love for her. And she began to dare to believe that, well, maybe God hadn't given up on her after all. It's kind of like she keeps bumping into chesed. Through Ruth's promise of profound loyal love that we just read, as Ruth makes good on her promise and works really hard gleaning to provide food for them both, that's another act of chesed. As she sees that Ruth just happens to find herself working in a field that belongs to one of their relatives, who also turns out to be full of chesed. Boaz provides protection for Ruth, generously makes sure that grain is left in the field so there's something for Ruth to glean. And as she sees Ruth continue to work hard for 4 months, through both the barley and the wheat harvests, she continues to see Boaz making sure that they're taken care of. Chesed, chesed, chesed. And over these 4 months, Naomi starts to slowly hope again. At the beginning of chapter 2, when Ruth offers to go and glean food and glean and get them food, Naomi just says, "Go, my daughter." No blessing, no encouragement, no gratitude, just, okay, fine, you go. But by the end of chapter 2, we hear some warmth in Naomi's voice. When she hears how generous and kind that Boaz has been to Ruth, she says in verse 22, "It's good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." She's expressing concern for Ruth and beginning to see some goodness in the world again. So now we get to chapter 3. In today's part of the story, we're going to see hope come fully alive in the lives of Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. So we're going to read the whole chapter. This is a really fun part of the story. All right. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, and do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do.' And she replied, 'All that you say, I will do.' So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, 'Who are you?' And she answered, 'I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer.' And he said, 'May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you've not gone after younger men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now, it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he's not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning.' So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you're wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. Quite the story, right? Life has changed a little since then. Farming's changed, customs have changed, marriage proposals have changed, although I'm not sure that that was typical for the time. Our farmers still work very hard at harvest time, but after they run the combine all day, they get to go home and sleep in their own bed at night. Today, I want us to look at all the ways that we see hope playing out in this atmosphere of chesed. First, we see that hope cares for others, not just itself or themselves. Right at the beginning of chapter 3, thank you. You took care of me, Amanda. Sometimes I forget to click, but Amanda's got me covered. Thank you. Right here at the beginning of chapter 3, we see Naomi's hope has grown. It's grown more. She's no longer consumed by her own bitterness and the loss of the future that she'd imagined for herself. And she's got room in her thinking to consider that there may be a way for Ruth to look forward to more than just a life of gleaning. She's gone from simply wanting Ruth to be safe while she gleans to wanting Ruth to actually have a secure future where she wouldn't even need to glean. In chapter 3, verse 1, she says, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you? And the word rest means rest in the sense of a settled place or a home. She's seen Ruth work so hard all summer, and she wants her to be able to settle down and be secure rather than scraping by year after year. And we've already seen this word rest back in chapter 1. Naomi encouraged her 2 daughters-in-law, Ruth and Orpah, to go back to their families in Moab and find rest, it's the same word, in the home of a new husband. Orpah returned, and we don't know the rest of her story, but Ruth refused, and she clung to Naomi. Back in chapter 1, Naomi didn't seem to imagine that Ruth might find that kind of secure rest in Israel. And to be fair, it probably wouldn't have seemed very likely because, as we've said, Moabites didn't have a good reputation in Israel. So she probably wasn't thinking that Ruth would be able to find a good husband and home there. But 4 months later, Naomi's been soaking in chesed, and her hope is getting bigger. Hope allows us to think about others, not just ourselves. When we're bitter and we can't imagine anything good, we tend to only think of ourselves, and we perhaps don't even notice anything good that's going on around us. We just get through the day, head down, doing what we have to do. We often tend to isolate too. We feel alone, even when we're around others, so why even try to connect? But you know, if we stay in community with people who love us, and church is an awesome place to do that, we begin to see that other people have needs too. Everybody's got stuff going on in life. Other people suffer. The people around me care about me though. And we start to care about them too. And I know Craig and I have experienced this again and again and again over the years, and I'm sure you can think of times that if you've been around here for a while that you've experienced that too, or maybe in some other community in your life. Naomi went from not even acknowledging that she had such a committed, loyal daughter-in-law with her in chapter 1 to actually seeking a good future for Ruth in chapter 3. The next thing we see about hope is hope dares to make plans. Naomi has a plan. It's a well thought out plan, and I don't think Naomi thought this up on the spot. I think she gradually put this together throughout the harvest season. She'd thought through the possibilities, she'd done her research, she considered the best course of action, And now she has all the details mapped out. She's got the time, the place, the wardrobe. She's got the instructions all put together. When I was growing up, my mom was pretty careful about handing out advice. You know, she didn't want to be the person who's, you know, always giving her opinion on everything, especially as we became adults. But my brother and I joke, she had this little phrase, "I will just say." "I will just say" meant that she had thought about this for days, probably a few sleepless nights, and she had thought exactly what she wanted to say, how she wanted to say it, what she wasn't going to say, and she had the whole thing mapped out. And we learned that, we joke about it to this day, "I will just say" is like, whoa, better listen up. I think that's kind of what was going on with Naomi here. She's like, "Hey, Ruth, I will just say, I got a plan." Naomi's asked around. She's found out when Boaz will be at the threshing floor. And Ryan talked about this last week. The threshing floor was usually a raised platform outside of the village. It was often on a hill, so it would catch the breeze as it came across. So there's a picture of a threshing floor in the Middle East there. And so they would spread the grain out on the floor. They would either have oxen walk on it, or they would beat it to separate the grain out from the chaff. And of course, the chaff is very light, so when they tossed it up, sometimes they'd use a basket like that to toss it up. Sometimes they'd use something called a winnowing fork to toss it in the air, and the breeze would carry the chaff away, and the good grain would remain. And the local farmers usually took turns using the threshing floor, and when it was their turn, they would sleep by the threshing floor because that's where their grain is, and they wanted to protect it. So Naomi told Ruth to get dressed up. There we go. She tells her to wash, put on perfume, and put on her cloak. And Naomi wasn't commenting here on Ruth's personal hygiene. She's telling her to make herself look good. And since this is going to be executed in the dark, this plan, she wants her to smell good too. And she's probably also telling Ruth to put away her widow's clothes and dress it in a way that makes it clear she's done mourning and she's available for marriage. She wants Ruth to present a very different image from the one that she presents when she shows up to glean. Ruth is going to be putting herself out there in an appropriate, but definitely an inviting way. And the next part's pretty wild. Naomi tells Ruth to wait until Boaz has eaten and had some wine, and note that the text says he was merry, he wasn't drunk, but he goes off to sleep in this sort of post-harvest satisfaction, kind of like after Thanksgiving dinner. And then Naomi tells Ruth to uncover his feet and lie down. Now, we honestly don't know if this was a standard practice, if this was a thing in that culture, or if it was just some random thing Naomi came up with. But it's obviously at least a little bit suggestive. And you have to wonder what respectable mother-in-law comes up with a plan like this. Ruth's going to be making it pretty obvious that she's looking for more than food. Naomi is placing a lot of hope in Boaz. He's been so generous and so kind all through the harvest season, and he's taken personal notice of Ruth and made sure that she and her mother-in-law are taken care of. And Naomi's trusting that he will continue to be honorable and will understand what Ruth is doing and not make false assumptions. Ruth is offering herself to Boaz in marriage, but the plan is risky. If Naomi's wrong about Boaz's character, he could take advantage of Ruth, or he could accuse her of attempting prostitution, or he could be embarrassed that she came to him at night and send her away, afraid that someone might find out. Remember, this was the time of judges, when people did whatever they felt was right. So a woman hanging out around the barn at night wasn't necessarily the best idea. And I can't help wonder if Boaz's kindness towards Ruth has given her hope, has to see herself as more than just a Moabite widow, to hope that God might have more for her than working hard gleaning for the rest of her life. Because sure, by God's grace, she'd been able to glean more than she expected, and she and Naomi were not going to starve, at least that year. And yes, God had led her to a field where the owner had offered her protection, But next year, she's going to have to do it all again. She's still a destitute foreign widow trying to provide for herself and her equally destitute widowed mother-in-law. She had to believe that her position in life and even her identity could change. Craig and I have been watching Poldark. Has anybody seen Poldark? Yeah, some few of you? Anyway, we've only watched a few episodes. This is not an endorsement for Poldark. So far, it seems pretty good. We're enjoying it, but we're still in the first season. Anyway, it's set in Cornwall, England in the late 1700s, and the main character, Poldark, is part of the aristocracy. He owns land, he owns a copper mine, and it's a time when class distinctions were very important. And in the story, he marries his maid, which is considered a scandalous breach of the class system. And when he first marries her, she continues all her maid chores, and she admits it's hard for her to even remember that she's his wife now. As time goes on, she starts to learn what it means to be his wife and what it means to be the lady of the house. And gradually, it starts to sink in, and the implications of her new situation sort of dawn on her, and she begins to actually believe that she has this new identity. She starts to look differently, to behave differently, and it takes her a while to believe that this kind of transformation is even possible. And to follow through on this plan, Ruth has to have the courage to believe that it's possible for her to become a wife in a secure home with a secure future, married to a well-respected Israelite farmer rather than a foreign widow destined to glean year after year just to eke out an existence. A local example of how Hesed gives people courage is through giving them hope is Shelter from the Storm. It's a shelter for single moms and their kids. So Shelter from the Storm puts women who would otherwise be homeless in an environment where they experience Hesed. Through the literal protection of living in an apartment in the shelter, through the generosity of supporters, through training and support to develop life skills and education, through advocacy and mentoring and spiritual support. This helps the women have the courage to hope that their lives can change, that God has more for them than being just a homeless single mom, that he intends for them to thrive rather than survive. And that hope that we can become whoever God intended for each of us is so important. If you think of one of the favorite verses to put on a graduation card, One of the favorite verses to put on a graduation card is Jeremiah 29:11. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare, and this isn't talking about the welfare system, it means well-being, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. God wants us to have hope for a good future. And that's part of the power of a community in which we experience Hesed, isn't it? Other people's kindness and generosity and encouragement helps us believe that we have value, and that God may have more for us than just a bitter existence. And I love the way people do that in this community. You're so good at calling out the things you see in each other and giving each other practical help, encouraging each other, cheering each other on. Sometimes when we start to hope, we need other people around us to have hope for us. And gradually, their Hesed reignites hope in us. So Ruth does exactly what Naomi told her to do. Conveniently, Boaz went to lie down at the far end of the heap of grain. It sounds as if he's probably not near anyone else, which makes it easier for Ruth to creep up unnoticed and lay by him. We don't get any commentary, but I would imagine that in the quiet of the night, she could hear her own heart beating out of her chest. This is full of innuendo. Ruth's putting herself in a very vulnerable position, and she's absolutely relying on Boaz being honorable. She uncovers his feet, so it's not surprising that he wakes up around midnight. His feet were probably cold by the breezy threshing floor. He's certainly shocked to find a woman lying there, and in the dark, he can't see who it is, and he has to ask. Ruth's answers carefully worded. I would imagine she'd rehearsed it a few times on her way to the threshing floor. What am I going to say? What am I going to say? I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. She doesn't just say who she is. She quickly makes her request before Boaz can react or start asking questions. Do you remember a couple weeks ago when Craig encouraged us to be an answer to our own prayers? When we pray God's blessings for other people, we want to consider how God may want us to be part of that blessing. Ruth is asking Boaz to answer his own prayer, because back in chapter 2, when Ruth asked Boaz why Boaz was being so kind to a foreigner, he blessed her in verses 11 to 12, but Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." He prayed that she would be rewarded for her kindness by the Lord, under whose wings she had taken refuge. Now she's asking Boaz to act on God's behalf and answer his own prayer by taking her under his wing as his wife. In verse 9, she's actually making two requests here, that he spread his wings over her as a husband, and also that she redeem Naomi's family land. As next of kin to Naomi's family, he had the right to buy back Naomi's husband's land, which they must have either mortgaged or sold off when they left for Moab. He would also marry Naomi's son's widow to keep the family line going. And Ruth is courageous here. She makes it clear, at least apparently in that culture, it would have been clear, what she's asking of Boaz. But she's also respectful. There's a sense in which she calls him up by showing him that she would like him to take on this role as her husband and redeemer. In a way, she's reminding him who he is and the power that he has to make a difference in her and Naomi's lives. And here we see that hope also builds confidence. Boaz's response gives us clues as to why Ruth had to approach Boaz and why he hadn't already offered to marry her and redeem her. In verse 10, he says to her, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness," and that's the word hesed again. He considers it hesed, kindness, "greater than the first, in that you've not gone after young men, whether poor or rich." So firstly, Boaz must be quite a bit older than Ruth, because he considers it hesed, kindness, that she hasn't gone after someone closer to her own age, whether for their money or their good looks, because why else would you go after someone poor, right? And then in verse 12, he says, "And now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I." So secondly, Boaz knew that there was someone more closely related who had first right of redemption before him. So perhaps he was waiting to see if they would make a move before he approached Ruth himself. We don't know. But Boaz responds in a way that's very consistent with his character. There's this sense in which his character and his worthiness are being tested here. This is highly charged, and no doubt it was a tempting situation. He could have taken advantage of her. But it would be difficult to read in this passage that anything sexual occurred. There's tension, there's innuendo, but there's nothing more. Boaz very kindly tells her right away not to fear, don't be afraid. Maybe she looked terrified. He probably realized it took a considerable amount of courage to approach him, especially out at a threshing floor at night. And he reassures her that he'll do what she's asking. "I will do for you all that you ask." What a relief that must have been to Ruth. Her advances hadn't been misunderstood, her character was validated, and he's going to honor her request. Whew. And why? What reason does he give for honoring her request? "For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman." And we've seen that word worthy before as well. At the beginning of chapter 2, when we first met Boaz, the narrator introduced him as a worthy man. From what we know of this time in Israel's history, there weren't a whole lot of worthy people around. So being worthy in terms of having virtue or integrity was actually something that stood out. It made Boaz different. It seems Boaz was older and he was still single, and we don't know why, but perhaps it was because he hadn't found any worthy women before this. And Ruth's request seems to raise up hope in Boaz too. Hope that a young woman might actually be interested in marrying him, and hope that he had more to offer as a redeemer and a husband than being a good landowner and a generous provider. But there is a bit of a plot twist here, isn't there? Boaz promises she will be redeemed, but he also says there's a closer relative of Naomi's who has first right of refusal. Dun, dun, dun. Wouldn't that be just a little bit alarming to Ruth? She'd come to ask Boaz to redeem her. She knew Boaz. He was a good guy. He was older, but he'd consistently lived out chesed toward her with his kindness, his protection, his generosity. And I think I'd be a little bit scared to think that I'd gone out on a limb to propose marriage to Boaz, only to find that I'd actually just offered myself to a complete stranger, someone totally unknown. And the story doesn't tell us what went through Ruth's mind when Boaz shared that with her. We're sort of left in suspense. Will her newfound hopes of a new future as Boaz's wife be realized, or is her hope a little more uncertain? She probably still at least had some hope that Boaz wouldn't allow her to be married off to a total scoundrel. And at least Boaz promises Ruth that her request will be honored. She will for sure be redeemed, either by this person who's more closely related to Naomi than he is, or if he's unwilling, by Boaz himself. But it definitely leaves us with some unexpected tension. And then we see that hope waits. Ruth stays, and he says, lie here till morning. I'm sure she didn't sleep. I don't think I would have. Presumably, she waited until there was just enough light to see her way safely home, but before anyone would be able to recognize her and know that she'd been there. Boaz once again shows his noble character here in protecting both their reputations. It's not enough that nothing inappropriate actually happened. It's important that they are above reproach and nobody has even cause to think that something might have happened. Before she went home, Boaz had her hold out her cloak. Wait. Am I in the right place? Yep. Before she went home, Boaz had her hold out her cloak and filled it with 6 measures of barley. And we don't actually know how big that or small that measure was, but it was obviously a lot. It doesn't say he handed it to her. It says he put it on her. Ruth was strong. She could carry home 30 pounds of grain at the end of her first day gleaning. So whatever amount this was, it took some effort for Ruth to take it home. And Ruth had already done really well gleaning. She and Naomi really didn't need more food, especially if Ruth's going to be married. They'd be well provided for. So you sort of wonder, what's Boaz doing? Why is he loading her up with all this barley? This isn't about the food, though. It's more of a pledge. It's a symbol of his commitment to follow through on what he said that he will do. And this is another place where it's fun to see the repeating words. In Ruth chapter 3, verse 17, Ruth tells Naomi that he said to her, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And do you remember back in chapter 1, Naomi went back to Bethlehem with a bitter proclamation, I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. We don't know if Boaz ever heard her say that. Probably not. But God heard it. And it's as if he wants to underscore to Naomi that however empty she felt at that point in her life, she could have hope. God wasn't going to leave her empty. So Ruth went home, and the ESV translates Naomi's question for Ruth in verse 16 as, how did you fare, my daughter? A more literal translation would be, who are you, my daughter? Are you still Ruth, the Moabite widow? Or are you Mrs. Boaz to be? Perhaps she wondered when Ruth showed up with a cloak full of barley whether he'd sent her home with a consolation prize or a promise. So when Ruth tells Naomi how Boaz responded, you can just hear Naomi's hope bubble up in her reply. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest but will settle the matter today. Naomi tells Ruth to wait. And it's not easy to wait, is it? Especially when you don't really know the outcome. Ruth waited for it to get dark at the threshing floor, hoping she'd be able to find Boaz and discreetly approach him. She waited for Boaz to wake up and find her there. She waited for enough morning light to get up and go home. And now she had to wait to find out who's going to redeem her and the land. Would it be Boaz, who she trusted and respected? The man who'd been so generous and kind over this last 4 months? Or would it be some other nameless relative she'd never met who may or may not be such a great guy? Naomi and Ruth are able to wait because they have hope that the outcome will be good. This chapter ends with a cliffhanger. We don't know exactly how or who will redeem them. But they have hope because Boaz has shown himself trustworthy. He's promising to make sure that the Lord's wings of refuge are extended over Ruth, whether that's by him or by the other relative. And this theme of taking refuge under the Lord's wings is one that we find in several places throughout the Bible. If you've ever watched chickens or cranes or geese, it's so fun to see their chicks instinctively run to them and run for shelter under mama's wings at the slightest hint of danger. They're absolutely certain, they trust and hope that their mother's going to protect them, that under their wings they're going to be just safe. Jesus uses this same picture himself. In Matthew, it's recorded in Matthew 23 and Luke 13. He's the same thing, describing his longing for us to run to him when we need hope and safety. This is Jesus speaking, and he says, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings? And you were not willing. Jesus wants to be those wings of protection and provision in our lives, and he's even more trustworthy than Boaz. When we take refuge under God's wings, we experience his hesed, and his hesed cultivates hope. God wants us to have hope. Not that certain things will happen, or that we'll experience certain outcomes, or that life will go a certain way, but hope in him. Hope that his hesed, his profound loyal love, his generosity and kindness towards us, and his abundant and satisfying love will work, be at work in our lives for our good. We never know where his hesed will leave us, but we can trust that when we put our hope in the Lord, he will lead us and help us and guide us. I never expected to leave England permanently, but I do believe God's providence brought me here. I started out with a medical career, never expecting to move into ministry. Craig started out as an engineer, never expecting that God would call him to be a pastor. We started our marriage in California, but we're so glad that God brought us to the Midwest to live and to raise our family here and be with all you fine folk. And it's not just about careers and relationships and life events. God's hesed works internally as well. I don't think I realized when I was younger how insecure I was. And don't get me wrong, I still have my moments, but over the years, God has really made me a whole lot more secure in his love, in his hesed. And he's given me a very real sense of this new identity as his beloved child. And I find as time goes by that God always has more. There's always hope. We can always grow and change and learn and enter new and sometimes surprising seasons of life. So if the worship team would like to come back up. When we have hope, we can consider other people and we can offer chesed, kindness, and generosity to them. And we can dare to make plans, believing that God has a good future for us, that he really does want us to live and not just get by. We can have the courage to fall through on the things that we feel he's calling us to do. And we can have confidence in who he's calling us to be and the life he's calling us to live, extending chesed to others along the way. And we can wait, even when the outcome's uncertain, because our hope is in Jesus the person, not necessarily in what we hope he'll do. We hope in his chesed love towards us, whatever it looks like, because we know ultimately it will be good. Let's pray. Lord, today I want to first bring to you those of us here who are feeling hopeless in some area of our lives, whether it's lacking purpose or resources or feeling alone, struggling with physical or mental health issues that just don't seem to have any resolution. Lord God, pour out your chesed love. Surround them with your abundant love and give them hope. Hope in you. You are hope worthy, Lord. Hope that you do have a good future for each of us, even if it's not the future we anticipate. And Lord, for all of us, show us where we're feeling vulnerable or discouraged or disappointed. Show us where we're running to other places for support and looking for hope and love apart from you. When we're overwhelmed or discouraged or disappointed, help us run to you, to the safety of the shadow of your wings. Help us trust your chesed love. Thank you that with you there is always hope. Thank you that you see things in us that we can't see in ourselves, and you want to bring those things to life. Thank you that you never lose hope for any of us. Thank you that as we place our hope in you, just as Ruth and Naomi placed their hope in Boaz, we can expect you to work things out